Hello, it's a longer one this week. Hope you like it. Here we go. Interval. I often perform these pieces in churches, and there's usually an interval when people have a glass of something and mill around, so this part of the book is the interval, and the tone is a bit different. The next chapter is also the longest. Sorry, but I'm a comedy writer, and one of the tricks is about setting the right expectations. If you read this book in a downstairs loo, you might require two or three sittings, for which I make no apology. At least no apology beyond my instinctive British one of just starting a sentence with "sorry" without even realising you're doing it, like I did in the previous footnote. I'm trying to explain how I feel about the miracles. It used to be fashionable, especially within my own denomination, the Church of England, to be sceptical about the miracles, and yet somehow here I am, not only attending an Anglican church, but also, at the time of writing, a member of the General Synod and the Archbishop's Council. I'd like to explain how that happened. Along the way, I mentioned Father Ted and the Vicar of Dibley. It does all come together, I promise. Maybe promote the book to the bedside table for a while and read it in bed. Losing your religion, or how I stayed an Anglican despite believing in miracles. The believers in miracles accept them, rightly or wrongly, because they have evidence for them. The disbelievers in miracles deny them, rightly or wrongly, because they have a doctrine against them. Orthodoxy, G.K. Chesterton. Autobiographies by Christians often have a chapter about doubts and those long dark nights of the soul, extreme tests and suffering where it felt like God wasn't there, or that this whole Christian story felt like a fabric of interwoven myths, embellishments and politically motivated mind tricks. The title of this chapter would suggest this is my chapter like that, but it isn't. Or at least, it's not about my doubts. This chapter is about the doubts of others. The chapter title is derived from the mournful song Losing My Religion by R.E.M. that was everywhere in the early 90s. It felt like a better title than the first line of the song You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate about believing in miracles. Do I believe in miracles? In the Gospel accounts, the miracles of Jesus are rarely questioned or doubted. Even when Lazarus is raised from the dead in John 11, the reports from those who were there are assumed to be true. In fact, they worry that this will make Jesus too popular. Read the Gospels carefully and you will see that the scepticism of Jesus' enemies comes from a logical standpoint, not a faith one. But it's not the logic that you would expect. It was widely believed that God did not answer the prayers of the unrighteous. Jesus, being an unrighteous, blaspheming Sabbath breaker, will not have his prayers answered. System error does not compute. Turn off and on again. That was then, this is now. Do I believe the miracles recounted in the Gospels? Do I believe that Jesus turned water into wine? Did he feed 5,000 people? And then 4,000 people, Matthew 15, 29-39. Did he raise Lazarus from the dead? Yes, yes, yes. And yes, I believe in miracles in the Bible without hesitation. I believe that my view has made a resurgence in the Church of England in recent years, as I will explain in a moment. And in the style of G.K. Chesterton, I would say that it's not just possible to believe in miracles, but that it's impossible to not believe in them. Back in the 1990s. 30 years ago, many in the church were concluding they didn't believe in the miracles, or that they were not required to. After all, science was growing in its explanatory power, and sensible, enlightened graduates, including ordained clergy, didn't believe in superstitious nonsense. And once they began to pull on that thread, the whole shroud started to unravel. Not only did they not believe in miracles, they were also losing their religion. Doubt was everywhere, being continually heaped on the foundations of the Christian story. On the recommendation of my delightful church-going cousin Simon, I read a book I was assured was a bestseller, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail by Michael Bagent, Richard Lee and Henry Lincoln. This was the book on which the central conspiracy of The Da Vinci Code was based. Not prone to doubt, I found The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail unconvincing, but I figured that, if true, it would probably come up during my theology degree at the University of Durham. It didn't. With this in mind, in 1994, I chose a course entitled The Intertestamental Period, with special reference to the Dead Sea Scrolls. I wanted to do the course partly because the lecturer was excellent, but also because the other sensationalist paperbacks were now suggesting the writings of the Dead Sea sect, hushed up by the Vatican, cast even greater doubt on the Christian story. Long story short, the Dead Sea sect were a pretty weird bunch who were in no way representative of mainstream Jewish or Christian belief. The origins of Father Ted. The year 1994 also saw the launch of a couple of brand new sitcoms that are oddly relevant. One, on Channel 4, was called Paris. You probably missed it or don't remember it, mainly because it's rarely repeated, being not very good. On my Sitcom Geeks podcast, I had the privilege of speaking to writer Graham Linehan about it, and he explained why. Long story short, they didn't know what they were doing and refused to take notes or change anything. Being slightly geeky for a moment, the plots were essentially too long and they didn't want to cut anything, which means they had to make cuts in the edit. At that point, the only way to cut the show down to 26 minutes is to cut jokes rather than story. If you cut story, it stops making sense, but you can cut jokes, so it makes sense, it just ends up not being very funny. This, ultimately, was the problem of Paris. These lessons were learned and carried over into Father Ted, which followed a few years later. Being a writer myself, I am, of course, much more interested in failure than success, which is why when Dave Cohen and I interviewed Steve Moffat for the podcast, the thing I wanted to know about most was not Sherlock, Doctor Who, Coupling or Press Gang, but the much-loathed BBC One sitcom from 1997 set in a school called Chalk. In my defence, failure isn't just more interesting than success, it's also more educative. Father Ted was intended to be a vitriolic attack on the Catholic Church, but it was too quirky and affectionate to deliver on that score. We loved Craggy Island, a place where the Catholic Church hid troublemakers, idiots, deviants and drunks. The faith of Father Ted Crilly is genuine to a point. Does he believe in miracles? Maybe, but he is a vain pragmatist. Sometimes a miracle might need some help. Father Dougal's faith is utterly naive and often absent, and Father Jack is the whiskey priest with other problems. Everyone watching would have been well aware of cases of sexual abuse that had been coming to light in the mainstream media throughout the 1990s. In short, everything from miracles to the authority of the Catholic Church was being questioned. The Vicar of Dibley. In 1994, we also saw the debut of a cosier clerical sitcom set in the Anglican Church. Also a huge hit, The Vicar of Dibley centred on a new female vicar. The Church of England had recently allowed women to become priests, and this change lent itself to an interesting situation that felt fresh and original. Written by a master of comedy, Richard Curtis, it quickly became a firm favourite of the nation. Look at church attendance figures and you will see them dropping throughout the 1990s, going from bad to worse, so it may seem odd that the increasingly faithless nation would take The Vicar of Dibley to heart. The genius of the show is not that Geraldine, Dawn French, is passionate about Jesus, although her faith is clearly genuine and sincere, along with her love for Sean Bean. Religious faith is not a great emotion in comedy or drama. One main reason for this is that the religious motivation is hard to empathise with if you don't have it. Geraldine's prime motivation isn't for her flock to follow Jesus, but for them to like her. Being kind to Geraldine, we can say she falls into the trap of believing that if people like her and she likes Jesus, then people will like Jesus and be drawn to him. There is plenty of theology to support this view, but it's often quite painful to watch. And we're back to the trendy vicar who preaches the water into wine miracle as, hey, Jesus loved a party too. This is why she ends up eating three Christmas lunches on Christmas Day, because she can't say no to anyone. She's too nice. That's a universal flaw everyone can identify with, even if it's not their own besetting sin. In a way, Geraldine is a female version of the Derek Nimmo type of vicar, which still had some resonance in popular culture in the 1990s. For more on this type of thing, have a look at Bryony Taylor, More Tea Vicar, Christians on the Telly, The Good, the Bad and the Quirky, and the later chapter in this book where I mention all gas and gaiters. What was the main overall effect of this? Mainstream comedy tends to reflect current attitudes rather than challenge or subvert them, so it wasn't telling the audience anything it either didn't know or hadn't subconsciously suspected. It did perpetuate the view that the Church of England was cosy and reassuring, and that the faithful laity, at least, were oddballs. A common thread. But the regulars in Dibley have one common attribute beyond eccentricity. Alice, Owen, Jim, Frank and Hugo are stupid. Being a sitcom, we shouldn't be surprised at the idiocy of the characters, and I'm not accusing Richard Curtis of implying that only credulous morons are Christians. Geraldine isn't stupid and is clearly well educated. David Horton, Gary Waldhorn, is smart, but he is also a mean misogynist. All the other characters, however, are backward. Do the members of the congregation in Dibley believe in miracles? Probably, but mainly because they are uneducated or gullible. Those with a graduate degree, the majority of clergy, all of whom have been to some kind of theological educational setting, know better. After all, how could you be a well-educated modern person and still believe in miracles? One way would be to stop being modern and to become postmodern. The Reverend Anthony Freeman tried this. It didn't quite work out. Never mind the cassocks. A couple of months before The Vicar of Dibley landed on BBC One, a current affairs show called Here and Now interviewed a clergyman called Anthony Freeman. He was priest in charge of St Mark's Staplefield in West Sussex until it was clear that he no longer believed in God. He would have explained his position with greater nuance, but essentially he held a postmodern view that God is subjective and could be found in our hearts, but not reality. He said there should be a place in the Church of England for people like him, since a substantial number of priests and vicars share my views. Glenda Cooper, The Independent, 2nd of August 1994. I think we invited him to come and speak at the Durham Union Society. I might even have met him. I remember the story breaking and a picture of him in the press, walking along in a black cassock looking rather dramatic. But the story wasn't a surprising one at the time. When he implied that his kind of scepticism was widespread among the clergy, no one was genuinely shocked. He was only saying out loud what many knew to be the case. That bishop. This was the time when the even more educated elites were prepared to say the unsayable as the nation continued to lose its religion. The Bishop of Durham, David Jenkins, was throwing doubt on the resurrection of Jesus Christ itself. He did not say it was a conjuring trick with bones. Not quite. He said it was not just a conjuring trick with bones, but the presence of the word just in that sentence did not help him as much as he thought. When this story broke, there was some clutching of pearls in the pews, but no one was surprised that a Church of England bishop should talk like this. He was a highly educated man. And highly educated men know that you do not take the Bible literally. How could you? Yes, we Anglican. So, back to me. Given the picture painted by the Vicar of Dibley and the statements of Anthony Freeman and a senior bishop, the City of Durham in 1994 was a place of doubt. I was not, and am not, one who doubts the fundamentals of the Christian faith or the miraculous. So the chances of me becoming any kind of Anglican seemed pretty low. When I arrived in Durham and was looking for a Sunday service, I heard that the church of choice was St Nicholas. That was the Anglican church in the marketplace with a tall spire, although everything in Durham is dwarfed by the cathedral and castle. St Nick's appealed to me as it claimed a solid evangelical heritage. In the late 1970s, the vicar of the church had been the famously evangelical George Carey, who had risen to be Archbishop of Canterbury. But he was an outlier. It is said that he was not the choice the Church of England wanted, and that it was the result of the bloody-minded Methodist Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in her final days choosing the wrong name. On his appointment to the primacy of England in 1991, George Carey was portrayed by spitting image as a swivel-eyed, tambourine-banging, born-again Christian who would sometimes say kumbaya. This was clearly meant to be insulting and satirical. I found it reassuring. Our Archbishop seemed to have a vibrant, biblical, spirit-filled faith. He believed in miracles. That was a good start. Maybe there was a place for me in the Church of England. I gave St Nick's a go. No, we Anglican't. I didn't last long at St Nick's. It was okay, but only okay. I don't think anything was wrong, but soon most of my friends from the Christian Union, and a girl I liked at the time, were attending a church up the road led by the excellent Bible teacher and preacher called Bob File, who also lectured at Cranmer Theological College. This was an unusually evangelical place of worship in the United Reformed Church, a denomination I'd never heard of. Since then, church history has shown me that the very name United Reformed Church is comic. The odds of anything being both united and theologically reformed are very slim. Heaven knows I'm an Anglican now. So what has changed since 1994? Why am I an Anglican now? And not just an evangelical who happens to attend a Church of England church, but someone who has stood in elections in the Diocese of Bath and Wells and has given many hours and days to read lengthy papers and attend meetings of the General Synod and the Archbishop's Council. There are many reasons. They begin with the foundational documents and the inspiring history of the reformers who wrote them, like Cranmer, Hooper, Ridley and Latimer. But another reason, oddly, relates to miracles and who believes in them. Through numerous meetings with ordained and lay leaders of the Church of England, I've almost always encountered genuine, optimistic faith in Jesus Christ. It is the kind of faith that believes in miracles, or at least has an openness to consider them and take them seriously. Three tribes. I should add that the kind of faith espoused by the different tribes within the Church of England are not always something I agree with. For those who aren't aware, there are three main types of churchmanship in the Church of England, which form three main groups within the General Synod. I shall attempt to summarise these in a single paragraph, thereby enraging everyone in equal measure. Here we go. The evangelicals take the Bible as the supreme authority in all matters and seek to establish the primacy of the preaching of the word, both for evangelism and discipleship. Next, we have the Anglo-Catholics, who see the sacraments and rites as the main way in which Christ is proclaimed and the faith of the Christian is nurtured and encouraged. Then we have the progressives, who may have sympathy with the evangelicals, in fact, many once were, and an affinity for the rituals, but their passion is changing the church and, where necessary, core doctrines in order to be relevant to society. Each of these has its merits, and on a good day, each group would claim to have sympathy for and fellowship with the other two. Each of the groups also has wings of its own and splinter groups, but each group is passionate about its own convictions, and the faith, as each understands it, is genuine. Status symbols. My theory, untested and untestable, is this. In the past, up until the 1980s perhaps, people might have been brought up in the Christian faith and, given its special status in society, have pursued a career in the church. This would not bring just status, but also a home, a regular income, and the possibility of being a bishop in the House of Lords or the dean of a cathedral. It worked for Cardinal Wolsey, famously the son of a butcher. But what about having to believe in miracles? Everyone knows they didn't happen because they couldn't have. Well, they can be spiritualized or theologized out of existence. Once you get there, making God a concept that dwells in human consciousness is barely a hop, skip and a jump away. Therefore, Anthony Freeman could claim that a substantial number of priests and vicars share my views. Those days are gone, as are those priests and vicars. After all, who'd be a vicar now unless they were highly motivated? It's not a high-status job and hasn't been for decades. It's demanding and exhausting. If you are well-educated or have a degree, and since tax bans changed in the 1980s, you could make significantly more money doing virtually anything else in management, law or business. And if you want to be both well-paid and highly respected, become a GP. They are the new priest class. As our society has grown richer, the pay, conditions, pressure and accommodation of stipendiary ministry in the Church of England are no longer attractive to the would-be Anthony Freemans, who look at the remuneration package and perks and discover they don't believe it half as much as they thought they did. And the likes of David Jenkins might find a home in academia rather than the House of Bishops. That, at least, is my theory. And this is why there is a home for me in the Church of England, a home for an evangelical who wholeheartedly believes in the miracles of Jesus and his literal resurrection and curious ascension and promised return. But I don't think I'm unusual. I'm just being honest. I say I believe in miracles because we can't not believe in them. And I'm going to cite one more sitcom in the interval that has taken a slightly serious tone. Don't worry. Jokes will be back soon, once everybody's topped up their drinks and been to the loo. Crises of faith. Some clergy do have a crisis of faith while in Christian ministry. This doesn't happen as often as TV storylines would suggest. The burdens are high and the job is potentially endless, especially if you really do believe and want to help people. If you want to see what that looks like, there's a sitcom for that too called Rev. But while some clergy identified with it, as it addressed the exhausting but lonely job of parish ministry, it was not a mainstream hit. It was not intended to be. It was a window on a world that the mainstream has learned to ignore almost completely. The Church of England. I found the series frustrating to watch, but I'm not in full-time paid Christian ministry and I'm not plagued by the doubts of the wonderfully named Adam Smallbone, who goes on a journey towards doubt and despair. But even Rev shows us a divine, miraculous encounter during Adam's darkest hour. He meets a nameless character, played by Liam Neeson, who tells Adam that we all have our cross to bear. As the scene unfolds, we are clearly invited to believe that this isn't a homeless man, but Jesus. Adam is having his own transfiguration. No matter how sceptical we become, even when it tips over into cynicism, we cannot extinguish the hope that we have that sometimes God breaks through into our reality and does something we thought impossible. That's what a miracle is. It's a sign of hope. And hope is something we can never extinguish. If we're honest, we must admit that not believing in miracles is the most intolerable burden. Interval over. Lights are going down. Careful where you put your glass. Don't kick it over. Well, that took a lot longer to record and edit and put together than it did for you to listen to. So if you want to help me by supporting this podcast, why don't you go to the show notes and get a copy of my live show, Water Into Wine, or get a copy of the book via Amazon, or go over to my Substack and find out more about what sort of things I get up to. That would be great. Thanks for listening. Speak to you next time.